welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you here with us Wednesday morning, as we are every week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. My guest, my leadoff guest this morning is Jason Miller. He's the executive editor of Federal News Radio, and been trying to get him on for a while, but he is one of the busiest people I know, one of the genuinely busiest people I know. So, Jason, thank you for being here.
Hey, Mike, my pleasure. It's been a while since I've last got to come on your show, so yeah. We have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, you were very interested in this latest executive memo from the Executive Office of the President, the OMB, M1407 in Washington jargon.
It's the best jargon.
Yeah.
Now, this one is their annual budget guidance.
Okay.
And now, that's not unusual. They put out a budget guidance every year around this time. In fact, I was just at a conference recently, and someone actually said, I think you're a little late on your annual budget guidance. And mm-hmm. and the OMB person's response was, well, it's a goal. It's not always has to be out on the 1st of April or whatever the date was at the time. But this is fascinating. This is out actually earlier than last year. And let me just point out a couple things, and then we can get to talking about it more specifically. In the past, OMB's asked for a bigger cut. So this year they're saying agencies should look at their discretionary budget and say, tell us how you're going to cut 2% out of your discretionary budget. Last year, it was actually they asked for two numbers. They asked for a 5% cut, and then they asked for a 10% cut with a idea of how you're going to reinvest that other 5% that you cut. So this is only 2%. That means things are getting better from an agency discretionary budget perspective, because 2%, let's face it, that's not a ton of money, generally speaking. Now, the other thing that this does, which I find interesting, is it really focuses on the president's management agenda. We have not heard a lot about what the president's management agenda is, how it's going to work. We know it focuses on, you know, four different areas: effectiveness, efficiencies. We can go through them later. But it's saying, how are you going to take your budget and really focus on these areas of IT, customer service, and really workforce issues, employee engagement? So I think there's a couple really interesting things that are happening here. Let me add one more thing to it, since as I'm thinking about it. The other piece of this is they're saying to agencies, cut 2% of your discretionary budget, but for those programs that are working well, tell us how you'd add 5% to those programs that are working well, and tell us why they're working well, and what would you do with that extra money? So they're giveth and taketh.
That's an unusual twist in a document like this. I marked a couple of things here, and one of them, it says, with a focus on long-term saving rather than short-sighted, short-term austerity. So that's an interesting term of phrase.
I think that's a direct hit against Congress because of sequestration, because sequestration was all about the short-term savings, instead of really thinking about things on the long term and saying, hey, this program works, but what if we had just a little bit more money? Could we make it work even better? Or hey, or the opposite, hey, this program has been funded at high levels for the last 5 years, and we just can't seem to really accomplish anything with it. What if we cut it, or we cut a piece of it, or what if we cut a section of it off that's not working, but we have this other section that is working? So I think that's where that in part is coming from as well.
Well, one thing too, last year was last year, and as you said, it was a 5% cut. This year, talking about 2, and with a chance to make up 5 in some key programs. I wonder how much the world situation, which has changed dramatically, aka Ukraine, has to do with this.
Well, usually that will go on three areas: DOD, State Department, and USAID. Those are the three kind of international. It's hard to say because they're not really calling out DOD, or they're not calling out any agency specifically. But what they're saying is we realize that things are better because 5% cut, or it's been a 5% cut over the last few years. They're saying we realize that we think things are better from a tax standpoint, from a budget standpoint. So a 2% cut is all we're going to ask for. Now, whatever happens to that, you know, the president can submit their budget eventually and can cut 3% or add 5%, but it's all about what Congress does in the end. And I think you've been around long enough to know that, and I've been around long enough to know that Congress will do whatever they want.
Yeah, that's exactly. A budget is really a shopping list that you send an absent-minded husband to the store with. He never comes back with what everything's on it. One thing that intrigues me, this is being radio, and I guess we can post this online if people want to look at it. But in radio, for people who don't know, when we type out scripts and things like that, we have a system where in the newspaper business, we used to measure things by inch, column inch. In newspapers, we measure it by time. So, and I tested this one. It takes 9 minutes and 25 seconds to read this. That's a long time for a short attention span world.
Very much so. And we won't sit here and read all four pages to people. We promise we won't do that. That would be painful. But at the same time, I think what OMB is trying to do here, and again, I think we have posted this on federalnewsradio.com already. One thing about this is they do break it down to different areas. They do talk about discretionary budget. They talk about non-discretionary budget, so mandatory budget. So there's plenty of things that they do, and they break it down for you. So wherever your interest is, I think they kind of help you through that. And a four-page memo from OMB, let's be face it, it could be a lot worse.
It's a term paper from them, yeah. Yes. Well, I noticed in one of the things here, it says your submission should exclude across-the-board reductions to mandatory spending and appropriations bills, et cetera, et cetera. So they're very specific about what not to have in this thing.
Right, because I think that there's certain rules that they have to abide by, like mandatory spending, you can't cut it. Hence the name mandatory. And the focus has been both from a congressional perspective, but also from a administration perspective, where are you spending money where you want to spend it, and what programs, even though Congress or they're an internal priority from the secretary or the administration, are you spending money on that may or may not be good? And I think that this is a recognition of this administration really focusing on data. What's the data telling you? And they go through that in terms of, there's a whole section here about evidence and evaluation, tagging back to M1317, for those of you keeping score at home, where they're saying, you know, the next steps in evidence and innovation agenda, where they're saying, hey, we outlined this new policy that you could look at evidence to make decisions. How are you using that evidence to make decisions? And in fact, we've seen that a lot. You know, there's the performance.gov website. There's also a lot of the stat sessions. There's a tech stat and a portfolio stat. There's also an acquisition stat and a cybersecurity stat. And then there's also agency-specific stats. You've heard of HUD stat. There's FDA track, FEMA stat. So everyone is doing these kind of evidence-based discussions. I think this what this memo does, again, is and the budget guidance really is builds on those stat sessions. What does the evidence tell you, and what are you going to do with that information now that you have it?
Well, you know, they say with one of these good, what you'd call a resume that you turn in, there are certain key words, certain things you should put in it, and certain places. And this one seems to have its own set here. On one page two, it says, your submission, this is to the agencies, should exclude across-the-board reductions to mandatory spending and appropriations bills, blah, blah, blah. So they're again, being very specific about this and giving agencies, telling them what they want, what they expect out of this.
Yeah, and I think they have to be. I mean, that's why it's considered the budget guidance. And you know, this is going to help shape, as in agencies are really just getting started now, that submission for 2016, which will come hopefully in February, though this administration traditionally has been late in submitting their budget to Congress, so maybe March, maybe April in some regards. The other thing about this that I think is important to really look at is they're actually looking, again, going back to the evidence thing, the strategic reviews, right? So one of the things they're saying is that OMB has said before, let's make sure you do some strategic planning. In those strategic planning, you should do some strategic reviews in terms of the programs. Make sure you highlight what those reviews found in your budget. So I think this is all building on what we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years.
When you look at something like this, it's important, it's impressive, yet most people are not going to be talking about this at dinner tonight or tomorrow night.
I don't know why.
There are probably some places that will. I don't want to be – but what kind of people will be reading this, right, and who will have to act on it? How many feds will this touch directly as a – do this? This is part of your job.
You know, for me, from my perspective, I think this touches a lot of people. It obviously touches the CFO, the chief financial officer folks. It definitely touches the budget people. And then it also touches the program people, because the program people are the ones who have to come up with this idea about what do we want to spend money on, what don't we want to spend money on. I think it also is going to touch the IT folks, because there's a big push in here around the president's management agenda and the idea that, okay, how to do smarter IT delivery.
Let me ask, and then
the HR folks.
Let me ask you about the IT and HR. We have to take a short break here. Lauren Larson is giving me the signal. We'll take a short break. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
This is John Gilroy from FedTech Talk. Wanted to tell you about a local company that has had a national impact on airline safety. For the past three decades, Electromech has worked with federal agencies to make sure aircraft wiring is safe and reliable. Electromech is responsible for testing, inspecting, and analyzing a wide range of electrical wire interconnect systems. For a white paper on addressing fleet management needs, please visit electromech.com. That's electromec.com.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Join us next Sunday, May 11th. We'll have Gail Gann talking about her new pastry book and cocktails and desserts. It's going to be sweet in studio with the new Red Light Restaurant.
That's Foodie and the Beast this coming Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
This week on AFSEA Answers, on the road to the joint information environment. I'm Max Kakis. Joining me for an update on the Pentagon's GIE with DOD Deputy CIO Dave DeFries. What happens when a DOD project has no program of record? And a preview of the AFSEA GIE Mission Partner Symposium. AFSEA Answers, 2:05 p.m. this Friday on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. Online anytime, worldwide, at federalnewsradio.com, keyword AFSEA.
Would you trust someone with disabilities to test high-tech protective combat gear? Our armed forces do. Source America provides the military with a highly trained, exceptional workforce, people with significant disabilities. In fact, Source America provides vital expertise to thousands of federal customers across the country. For everything from contract closeouts to food service to call center support. Learn more at sourceamerica.org. An Ability One authorized enterprise.
CXOs and government IT are implementing shared services strategies. Organizations are combining buying power for similar IT needs to lower prices, improve ROI on IT spending, close productivity gaps, and better deliver missions in a resource-constrained environment. Join AFSEA Bethesda on Thursday, May 8th at the Bethesda North Marriott to learn from CIOs, CFOs, and CAOs about their experiences offering shared services and buying into them. Register today at afsiabethesda.org/maybreakfast.
Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Jason Miller. He is the executive editor and one of our many IT experts. You may be the man as far as this operation goes. Jason, we were talking about the new OMB budget submission or memorandum to agency heads about what they want the 2015 budget to have, the budget guidance, and not have in it. Very specific in both areas. Before the break, you were talking about the importance of IT in this and HR for human resources.
Right. So one of the things they do talk about is you had said, who does this affect? And definitely, obviously, the finance people, the budget people, but IT and I think HR are a big player in this. And the IT, let's start with there, the IT folks. One of the president management agenda items is smarter IT delivery. How can agencies do a better job in terms of delivering IT, whether it's internally or to external customers? And I think that this budget guidance is saying to them, you know, you need to focus on this is important to us as an administration. It's got to be important to you. So therefore, tell us how you're going to do it. And one switch that I've seen recently from this administration, and not just the people from the White House or OMB, but really from agencies more generally, is this discussion. They were talking a lot about efficiency. We got to be more efficient. We got to spend our money more efficiently. Now they're talking about effectiveness. And you say, okay, well, that's just a buzzword. We've heard it for years, efficiency and effectiveness. But in many regards, effectiveness is a new term of art from this administration. And they're saying, when you're doing whatever you're doing, whether you're spending money or providing a service, how effective are you at providing that service? And I think that is something that is really marbled throughout this entire memo, this idea of effectiveness. Can you deliver it better, cheaper, faster? And I think that's a very interesting twist that we hadn't maybe seen before.
Make sure it works and works as efficiently as possible.
Right. It's not just about the price, but what positive results are you getting and how do you measure them? And again, that goes back to earlier what we were talking about, the evidence-based budgeting, the idea of using evidence to make decisions.
Okay, now this memo was dated May 5th. when will agencies, I know they'll jump on it immediately, but when will the administration and OMB get feedback from the agencies?
So my experience is it takes basically all summer, and budgets are initially submitted sometime right around Labor Day, early September. So you make your first budget submission, and then from September to about November timeframe, maybe Thanksgiving, you're doing a series of back and forth. OMB reads it, they ask questions, they you know, you have discussions, and then sometime in that November timeframe, November to January, you go through what they call the pass back process. Now, a lot of people who are in the budget world are familiar with this idea, but this is when OMB gives you your budget back, and you have one last chance to look at it before it becomes final. And if you have any arguments, you better make them now or forever hold your peace. Now, I love the time of the year. The pass back is my favorite time of the year because OMB puts a big secretive, you know, umbrella. If you remember Get Smart, the TV show,
yep.
The Cone of Silence.
Exactly.
They put the Cone of Silence around the pass back so no one talks about it. Yet every year I manage to find people who will tell me about it. So either I'm a really good reporter or people don't take their Cone of Silence very seriously.
Probably both. Yeah.
I like to think a little bit of both.
Yeah.
And then by the time that happens, you know, early January, they finalize it, and then they get it out in February. So you see, that's why it takes so long. But for agencies, it's tough. That's why the evidence piece is so important, because you're being asked to plan so far in advance. And I think that's a big complaint about the budget process more broadly.
Yeah, and again, the world situation changes just beyond belief every year. Whether it's military, it could be another tidal wave in Japan. You just don't know. So yeah, how much wiggle room is there in this?
I think from a budget submission standpoint, agencies have a fair amount. Remember, we're only talking about the discretionary budget, and I think that's something like only one third of the total spending that the government does. So, you know, the mandatory spending includes like Social Security,
food stamps,
right? Yeah. Food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid, some veterans benefits in some ways is mandatory spending. So there's some wiggle room, but not a lot. I mean, they're only asking for a 2% cut, so you're only going up or down by, you know, 2 to 5%. And that's not a whole lot. So, you know, agencies kind of, as long as Congress and the administration get along, which, as we've seen mm-hmm. with shutdown and other problems, they haven't been, it's they know their budget year over year for the most part. I mean, it's hard to plan until it's done, it's done. But for most part, you get an idea of what your budget's going to be, you know, by the beginning of that next fiscal year for the 2016. Now, again, Congress can act and change everything, but you at least you know where you're starting it at.
Right. Well, I know this is a blueprint and it's a long-term thing and all that, but people worry about what people want buyouts. People do not want reductions in force. Do you see downsizing in this? Is this anywhere to go except up?
Right. As far as this budget document, there's no HR piece to it. You know, what's it mean for the size of your workforce? But one of the things they do highlight is the idea of employee engagement. And the workforce is a major priority for this administration from the sense of a president's management agenda. Now, how they engage and what they do with that engagement is a whole separate discussion. You can agree or disagree with it, but at least they're putting it out there to say this is important to us. One thing about reduction in force is that if Congress continues with sequestration, I think agencies have already cut all the low-hanging fruit, and that's where reduction in forces could come in.
Okay, you were working on, you've put out a piece, and it's the headline is OPM, GSA, Combined Forces for a New Take on Training Contract. What's that all about?
Now, this is called the TMA contract, the Training and Management Assistance Contract, and this contract has actually been around for like 15 or 20 years, and it's a very, very popular contract across the government. And what agencies can do is come to OPM and say, hey, I need to set up a training program around, you know, widgets, because we love mm-hmm. that in the world of procurement. I need to find a contractor to do that. So they can go through TMA and this contract and use it. Now, the other thing they could do is say to OPM, we need help. We're not sure what the training would look like, but we know we need help, and they could hire somebody to help them develop the training and put it together. So it's been a very popular contract, and OPM was going to recompete it and then had major problems. Something like they had bids come in and sat on the bids from vendors for like 15 months, which is an incredible amount of time. And then last February, they canceled it. They just said, nope, we're done. We're not going to do a recompete. So just in the end of April, they announced that they would work with GSA more closely, and GSA will take over the entire training piece of this. The entire acquisition piece of this, and OPM would still continue with the services. So as soon as GSA makes the awards and does all the contracting and acquisition support, OPM would then do the normal role of helping agencies find the best contract vehicle.
That seems like the smart way to do it. I mean, that's what GSA does.
Right, absolutely. And in many ways, it's the idea of they're using the term strategic sourcing, something that I'm sure our audience has heard a lot about, but they're not using it in that sense of I'm going to buy pens and pencils and I'm going to buy the lowest cost possible, but they're going to have a kind of a centralized procurement action where all the vendors will kind of go through and then all the other agencies can find. And so they're using strategic sourcing in a bit of a different way than in the past. Now, this new contract could be worth billions. I've heard as much as $5 billion over the life of the contract. And I got some data from Bloomberg Government, and they found that this is back in 2010, agencies spent $700 million through the TMA contract in 2010 and more than $600 million in 2011. Now, remember, this was at a time when budgets were going down. So even though if that number is less, if that number's dropped another $100 million for 2012 and 2013, you're still talking about $400 to $500 million a year. So it's quite a bit of money.
Yeah, it is. And I'm thinking, too, that the IRS has been hit by Congress by sequestration and various things. So they're having some revenue problems.
Right, and that's the other piece of it is that agencies' training budgets have all been cut. So how will this contract make it easier for agencies to get training? Because is it could be cheaper? Is it going to be easier? Will they go through GSA to do the acquisition piece, so it won't cost them as much to do that acquisition side of it? It's hard to say. Now, this again, very popular contract. There are other avenues for training and assistance. For instance, GSA also runs the GSA schedule. Well, it's unclear how that's going to meet up with this TMA new contract, whatever it's going to be called. So there's some questions out there that I think we'll have to answer in the coming weeks and months as they finalize their acquisition strategy.
I guess virtually everybody in the Washington area and many other cities, you know federal workers, federal contractors. And several of the contractors that I know, and these are guys in their 40s, have recently had to move, change jobs. In some cases, they've been let go. In others, they could see the handwriting on the wall. Is there a nervousness in the contractor community about the sequestration, the fact that the unthinkable happened? We had shutdowns last year and furloughs, totally separate things.
Now, I think from a contractor standpoint, there is some nervousness, though. From all the contractors I've talked to and the associations that represent them, there's a calm that has come over them because of the two-year budget deal. Going back to our discussion on the budget guidance, I think contractors are not going to be happy to see a potential 2% cut of discretionary budgeting. But at the same time, I think the fact is Congress and the administration have come to an agreement, and that's a positive sign. Now, will a new budget be out on October 1st? Absolutely not. There's no confidence
that just,
in that.
That just doesn't happen anymore.
Right. So they'll have the continuing resolution. Now, how long will that continuing resolution go for, and what will it mean more broadly? That's where their nervousness comes in. But I think overall, vendors feel better about it. On the other hand, I think agencies there's still a lot of concern because we're seeing another round of buyouts. Mm-hmm. I think several agencies are starting that up again. And I think that the RIFs, reduction in force is not far away. I mean, OPM, for their HR solutions shop, which runs this TMA contract, actually is facing some, I think, 300 people. They're going to do a reduction in force. Now, they're hopeful to find them other jobs, obviously, but they're going to reduce their headcount. And I think that's a trend that we're going to see, quite a while as things move on and the budget picture becomes a little less cloudy.
Well, I speculated recently about this situation, and RIFs are very expensive. They're very disruptive because the government, you bounce senior people, particularly those with veterans preference, bounce somebody down. So they may want to get rid of me, but because I'm a veteran and I'm have the seniority, or you might go out the door when they're really aiming at me. I was speculating that the Obama administration may take a leaf from the Clinton administration's book. When the president wanted to eliminate 300 and something federal jobs, they contracted out a lot of them. They had a very few RIFs, but they started offering buyouts, and the buyouts enabled them to buy out the older guys, the senior guys, the veterans, and to protect the people that had been hired more recently. They called it the protecting their diversity gains. And I wonder if you see something like that's in the cards.
It's hard to say right now. There's not enough information about which agencies are going out with RIFs. We've seen the buyouts, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, this administration has done a lot to hire more veterans, to bring more veterans into the government. So I'd be surprised to say they're going to get rid of, if you will, or change the way they look at it without the veterans' preference. So I don't see that as being as much as a priority, considering how much administration, the focus they did.
Okay, Jason Miller, thank you very much. Hope to have you back soon. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com and Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What is DHS's acquisition strategy? What are the key procurement and acquisition challenges facing DHS? How is DHS improving the operational performance of its acquisition function? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Nick Nyack, Chief Procurement Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Tune in on Mondays at 11 for the Business of Government Hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
For nearly six decades, Ball Aerospace has provided distinctive contributions to advancing science and protecting the nation. From high-resolution global mapping of the Earth to finding unknown planets outside our solar system and putting actionable intelligence into the hands of warfighters, Ball applies visionary technology to enable scientific firsts and support our nation's strategic advantage. Agility to innovate, strength to deliver. Visit BallAerospace.com. That's BallAerospace.com.
Psoriasis and vitiligo are serious diseases. You've tried everything and have been disappointed. Now there's Xtract, a breakthrough treatment that provides long-lasting, safe relief. Xtract is FDA cleared for the treatment of psoriasis and vitiligo and is endorsed by thousands of dermatologists and hospitals because it works. Clinical studies show immediate results with up to 95% clearance. The in-office visits are fast, painless, with virtually no side effects. With thousands of providers treating patients all over the country, Xtract is covered by all major insurance companies and Medicare. We'll help you find a doctor close by, and there is no cost to you until you see results. Get your life back. Live free. Live Xtract Clear. For your no-cost treatment, call now 800-959-9852. That's 800-959-9852. 800-959-9852. Or visit xtracradio.com. Qualified patients, certain restrictions apply. Results may vary.
Are you looking for creative ways to transform your agency into a high-performing organization with a motivated and engaged workforce? As the leading expert in federal workforce development, Management Concepts has enhanced the performance of teams and organizations worldwide for more than 40 years. You have a vision for your organization? Management Concepts can help you achieve it. Learn more at managementconcepts.com/radio. General Dynamics Information Technology Cybersecurity Solutions, your best defense for the cyber challenges ahead. General Dynamics IT. To learn more, go to gdit.com/cyber.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Dennis Begin, he's Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy Installations and Environment.
We have our priorities for energy because they enhance warfighting effectiveness and operational efficiency. At the bottom of our rationale, firm base, is we're doing this because it improves mission readiness. And that's what we're all about for our Navy and Marine Corps.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
Welcome back to your turn, Mike Causey. Nice interview with Jason Miller, our executive editor here, and he explained that very complicated document, I think, very well. Coming up shortly, we're going to be talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times. But first, we have a segment. Lauren Larson, my producer, and I interviewed Catherine Archuleta, the director of OPM, the other day, and a very interesting session. And we started out by asking her about the importance of Public Service Recognition Week and saying good things about feds.
Hardworking, and they're so passionate about what they do. And they, frankly, they make this country so such a great place to live. You know, every day federal workers go to work, and the impact they have on citizens every day sometimes goes unnoticed. It might be about, you know, when they're boarding a plane or whether they're using a cell phone or, you know, even when they're visiting those national parks in especially so many throughout our country, or even when they're checking their mailbox. That's public service. Employees who are doing that day in and day out, and that's why we celebrate Public Service Recognition Week. It really gives us all an opportunity to thank the men and women for their service.
We've got a very large community of people here who don't work for the federal government, but they know what it does. I think it's called the good government community. How do they get out the message about what the government's doing, especially when we're in a period now when so many members of Congress are in a beat-up-the-bureaucrat mode?
Well, you know, I think especially in our hometown here, our citizens here know, our community members know what federal employees do and the good work that they do. So I think it's about telling one another and encouraging people to share the stories. Again, you know, the hashtag FedSpirit on Twitter, using Instagram and Facebook all give us an opportunity to use social media really to get that word out. And, you know, oftentimes these stories are so inspirational. They certainly are empowering and really informing about what federal workers do every day. So I hope people will use that social media, those social media sites to help us get the word out.
President Obama early on said he wanted to make public service cool again. Given the political climate, that's been an uphill fight, hasn't it?
Well, you know what? I think we're pretty cool. I think we love the work that we're doing, and our employees certainly look at themselves as being pretty cool. Every day, they not only do their own work, but they are often volunteers in the communities that they live in. And so I think that we have a great opportunity to continue to express how cool these jobs are. You know, I spend a lot of time outside the Beltway, and I talk to a lot of millennials, and I'm always grateful for the enthusiasm that they express in wanting to join the federal service and become part of the good work that goes on every day to change the lives of the American people. You know, we need to continue to do that. We've got a lot of programs that we work on through not only OPM, but through agencies across government that are specific for students and recent graduates. One of them is the Pathways Program, but there's many others. And we have an exciting opportunity right now, and certainly one that I'm grabbing hold of, to encourage more millennials, more mid-career individuals, and certainly senior executives to think about public service as the next step for them.
You know, we hear a lot about diversity, you know, making the government workforce look more like the American public, and it's a long-time goal. So how's it going?
You know, we're working really hard at that, and thankfully I've got a lot of help at my side, not only from the agencies, but also from nonprofit groups who understand that the fabric of America really needs to be represented in the people that serve them. And I think that the work that we're doing on diversity and inclusion is a really important one. We're working with our agencies on their recruitment efforts. We're working to improve USA jobs. And frankly, we're trying to really make sure that the way that we recruit is one that is responsive to the ways that people apply for jobs these days. I was just talking to my staff this morning about how do we reach out in ways that are new and different? How do we use social media? How do we make sure that as we do recruit, knowing that we are competitive, how do we stand up to that competition? So we're really working hard to reach out into new communities. My own travels, certainly the work that I do with my counterparts throughout government. We want to really create a value and an increased value, I should say, to diversity and to create the cultures of inclusion that once we do bring these individuals on board, that they're feeling that they have a role in service.
I've been anxious to ask you, too, whenever you take a new job, particularly if you come in at the top, there's always surprises, and some of them are good, some of them are not so good. How's that been for you?
Mike, you know I've been in government for a long time, and it's probably pretty hard to surprise me, but I have to say that one of the things that I do every day is try to reach out to employees across government through my own personal phone calls. And I keep thinking that I'm going to reach someone who's going to tell me how they really don't like their job and they really, you know, wish they hadn't made this investment in their career. But I can't find that individual yet. I'm so always heartened by the folks I speak to, the employees I speak to, and how enthusiastic they are. And when I talk to people who've been there in their jobs for 20 years, 30 years. I say, what keeps you here? They always say two things. One, I am supported by incredible leadership. And two, they say that they like who they work with and who they work for. So I keep asking that question in different ways to see if I get different answers. And the fact of the matter is that I am humbled.
Okay, yeah.
By the dedication and of our federal employees and why I'm so excited.
And what
about,
date is that?
Public Service Recognition Week this
18th.
Coming week.
We're excited to host you on May 28th. You'll be joining us on Your Turn with Mike Causey. And then you'll be sticking around for a web chat with our listeners for a half hour after the show. What would you like to tell feds as they prepare some questions for you?
It's not only questions, but ideas that I hope that they'll bring to me, because we're always looking to do things better. I also think that there's an opportunity for us to share stories about how, you know, the impact of federal workers on their lives. And I'm always open to good suggestions about how I can do my work better.
That's Catherine Archuleta. She's director of the Office of Personnel Management. She talked with Lauren Larson and myself about a variety of things. Very interesting. And I want a reminder, we are going to be having a web chat, the we being the director, Lauren Larson and myself, on the 28th of this month. So be thinking of some questions for her. And if you heard what she said there, she is anxious to get questions from people. And so far in her travels, she hasn't met any unhappy folks. So this is your chance, 28th of May. And now we're going to be talking with Andy Medici. Andy is a senior writer with the Federal Times. Andy, oh, I'm sorry, we need to go to a break. We'll take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM, and then we'll get to Andy Medici.
Volunteers are the backbone of many nonprofits, and Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington is no exception. I'm Renthia Ross, a volunteer and board member of the Fairfax County Boys and Girls Clubs. For the care and support of Boys and Girls Clubs in Savannah, where I grew up, I realized my dreams to go to college, law school, and become a lawyer. I'm a corporate executive with GEICO Insurance Company. My success was made possible with the support of my family and caring adults from the Boys and Girls Clubs. I urge you to give to the Boys and Girls Clubs so kids can grow up great. Go to bgcgw.org to donate now. Volunteers are the backbone of many nonprofits, and Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington is no exception. I'm Renthia Ross, a volunteer and board member of the Fairfax County Boys and Girls Clubs. For the care and support of Boys and Girls Clubs in Savannah, where I grew up, I realized my dreams to go to college, law school, and become a lawyer. I'm a corporate executive with GEICO Insurance Company. My success was made possible with the support of my family and caring adults from the Boys and Girls Clubs. I urge you to give to the Boys and Girls Clubs so kids can grow up great. Go to bgcgw.org to donate now.
Mythics Consulting is hiring. Mythics is an award-winning Oracle Platinum partner working to enable the Oracle-powered enterprise. And Mythics Consulting is looking for IT professionals that get the job done. Available positions in enterprise Oracle solution areas like engineered systems and fusion middleware. Mythics Consulting is the go-to Oracle systems integrator with open positions and ready to hire highly skilled IT sales and technical professionals. Go to mythics.com/careers.
Source America isn't a new country, but it is a place that creates job opportunities for an incredible workforce. People with significant disabilities. People who are fiercely dedicated to high quality work and amaze federal customers with the wide array of jobs they do. As an Ability One authorized enterprise, we make the federal procurement process a smooth one. Learn more at sourceamerica.org.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 21?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Tracy McRae. Colic. Your child's incessant crying can put you on edge and make you wonder if you're cut out for parenting.
They cry and they cry and they cry. And usually it's going to be in the late afternoon or early evening. And no matter what you do, you can't satisfy that child.
Colic, explains Dr. John Bachman, is a bit of a mystery. We don't really know what causes it, so we don't really know how to treat it. His advice? Keep calm.
The fact is you're not doing anything wrong, and you'll try all sorts of things. Interestingly enough, if we can get the parents to breathe and say, you know, this is going to be okay, it's going to end, and then we can calm them, that's going to help. Because certainly if you're nervous about it and the baby senses that, they'll cry more.
That can be hard, but it helps to know that most colicky babies improve by around 3 or 4 months of age. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
Government IT professionals, registration for management of change is now open. Reserve your seat at this premier education and training event. Join your government and industry colleagues as we recapture the excitement of government service through breakthrough innovations and fresh ideas. Hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council, Management of Change will be held May 18th through the 20th in Cambridge, Maryland. Register today at www.actiac.org. That's actiac.org.
FederalNewsRadio.com. It's the only place to read Mike Causey. Get the latest news on your federal pay, benefits, and retirement at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search term Causey.
Hey, Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. I was so anxious to talk to Andy Medici that I jumped the gun there. But now we are really going to be talking with Andy Medici, a senior writer with Federal Times. Andy, are you there?
Yes, I share your excitement, Mike.
Thanks for holding on. Listen, I don't know if you got to listen to the first part of this. Our executive editor, Jason Miller, was talking about the new OMB budget guidance that came out. And he mentioned the term RIF.
Well, that's always a possibility, and there are some low level things. We talked last week about the Air Force saying that they might do some RIFs as a last resort after other sort of attrition and buyout methods have failed. So that's never been taken off the table entirely, but you know, agencies do try to do that as a last resort.
Yeah, you know, I tried to read that document. It's in radio we measure things by time, by seconds, and I put it on the reading machine, and it came out to be, I think, 9 minutes, 25 seconds to read that, and that's at a normal pace, and this is such complex stuff. I don't envy the people who have to translate something like this into reality.
Well, that's one of those things, you know, the guidance like this, it's very complex because, you know, the government has a lot of different aspects to it and a lot of different aspects to the civil service system for the people that are in it. So guidance like this tends to for the uninitiated or for people like you and me, it's definitely long and complex, but it has to be in order to give agencies the sort of flexibility and that they need to go through these technical issues.
Yeah, and I guess as you said last week, the fact that we're into a 2-year cycle now, it was interesting. Jason said he thought some contractors were very relieved by this.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that the federal government should move to a 2-year budgeting cycle to provide more certainty, to provide more stability. You know, the VA does a lot of that on a 2-year cycle. And people, you know, people think it's good, you know, instead of having to rehash the same battles every year, you provide sort of a longer term for agencies to operate and for them to be assured of where their money's coming from.
Yeah, the long-term strategic thinking has never been a big thing with Congress.
And more recently, you know, as both you and me know, the sort of governing cycle has gotten a lot more chaotic. And although we have a sort of 2-year budget system set up now, you know, there's still going to be, you know, eight more years of sequestration, and Congress is going to have to keep fighting that over the years. So who knows what will happen after this cycle ends.
Right. And in the last few years, you've had the budget, the president's budget coming in later than it has been in the past. And then the reality is that Congress doesn't pass it, or the Senate will pass one thing and the House another. So it's really it's almost a kabuki theater exercise.
Well, yeah, I mean, really what it is it's a statement of priorities and principles by all the parties interested. You know, the president is laying out a budget that they think will show their best aspects, and the House will pass their own budget, and the Senate will pass their own budget, and they're all different, but they're all really a statement of priorities and principles, and then hopefully there can at least be some way to get to a compromise and pass a budget. But of course, as we know, some years they have not been able to, and we've seen the disastrous effects that can have.
Well, you know, the Obama administration and OPM, particular, have made a diversity a major issue. They want the workforce to look more like the American public, And so there have been a lot of minority hires, women that got. They've also been hiring veterans in as strong a position, I think, as I've ever seen in government. But when Jason Miller earlier was talking about RIFs, my thought was that RIFs are very costly and very can be destructive and unproductive, because you the senior people who have veterans preference will bump down into the ranks, and it seems to me like it would eliminate many of those diversity gains.
Well, RIFs are like an axe when you really need a scalpel, you know, and I think agencies are aware of that. The problem with RIFs is that they're sort of indiscriminate. You have to cut, and it does provide some financial relief at some point, but the damage it can cause to an office or an operating unit or, you know, to a branch of any agency can be severe. So agencies would rather see a decline through attrition, which is the easiest way, and then after that, you know, buyouts and early retirements or early outs. But, you know, RIFs are always on the table, and if agencies don't meet the goals that they lay out for themselves in a year, they might have to resort to that.
Yeah, we haven't had a round of RIFs since the Clinton administration when they were downsizing the government, and the vast majority of people who left were given buyouts. But there were some RIFs at that time.
That's correct. And, you know, we've seen some stuff more recently where agencies, they do buyouts. I think the Air Force actually said they had maybe 9 RIFs last year. They just have to meet those goals. And if they don't, with buyouts or early retirements, you know, that is a tool that they are willing to use, and they've shown that they can in the past.
What else are you working on?
Well, I think there's we always like to talk about the Postal Service, and there's a big debate over what are essentially improving conditions at the Postal Service. But it really depends on who you ask, because from an operational standpoint, the Postal Service has been in the black the last 4 or 5 months. But if you add in their prepayment of retiree health benefits, they're at a negative balance. So a lot of lawmakers and union people think that the Postal Service is in better financial shape, and so it doesn't need to cut more employees or end Saturday mail delivery. But instead, they should just focus on those prepayment issues while the Postal Service is still pushing for a wider reform.
Well, that's always intrigued me. The Postal Service is forced by Congress to make this prepayment. Defense isn't, Interior isn't, GSA isn't. Why them?
It was part of the sort of bargain legislation that was struck during 2006, the Postal Enhancement Act. And it required them to prepay 75 years worth of benefits over 10, which of course is a lot of money, about $5.6 billion a year. And it shows up on the balance sheets as red ink. And the Postal Service has really been unable to pay any of it. But it shows up on the balance sheets as a negative. And a lot of people say that, you know, if you just remove that issue, the Postal Service is in much better financial shape. It wouldn't have to keep downsizing the workforce. It wouldn't have to end certain mail delivery. And that, you know, they can move on from there.
Where are they now in this, in their proposal to put non-postal workers but postal operations in, was it Target?
Staples,
yeah, which is a logical place for it. But the postal unions argue, and I think many people would say correctly, that you're going to be hiring rather low-paid, low-wage people to be doing these postal jobs that are now done by sworn federal employees.
Well, that's always the case, which is, you know, what work should be done by federal employees? And you're right, Postal Service wants to put these. If you go into Staples now or to like Office Max or something, there'll usually be a UPS or a FedEx shipper there, and they want to break into that market as well. But the problem is what the union says, that they want to hire essentially what would be like Staples levels employees, so a lower pay, you know, less comprehensive benefits, and so they're pushing back against it. So I think a lot of it depends on how the landscape shakes out this year, and if there is postal reform that can get passed, it might give the Postal Service more latitude to do things like that. And at the end of the day, you know, the unions can only do so much to block that. So it really depends on how this year shakes out.
Yeah, and fewer union members, too, down the line. Huh?
Well, that's one of those longevity things. If you have fewer employees that are part of the union, then the union gets smaller and it has less influence. And that's something that's happened to a lot of unions over the years. And the Postal Service, you know, the Postmaster General has said that he wants to cut the number of career people by the tens of thousands if he gets this reform legislation. So that's just another way that the union might shrink over the next few years.
And that's a major deal, too, because you know it, I know it, those of us on the beat know it, but most federal employees do not belong to a union. They may be represented by one, but most of them don't belong. They don't have a card. They don't pay dues. In the Postal Service, it's the exception to the rule. The vast majority of clerks and letter carriers, which is the bulk of their craft, are union members.
That's correct. You know, you're right. Federal agencies, I forgot what the last count was, but most employees, while they're represented by the union in bargaining, they're not union members. And the Postal Service is the flip side of that. And for a lot of people, that's what's given them sort of a better ability to fight back against these proposed reforms.
Yeah, I think the Postal Service and the formerly the Tennessee Valley Authority were the only heavily unionized operations in government.
Well, no, you're right. And now we have to see if what kind of shape reform will take. And, you know, we've seen postal reform bills introduced over and over again. But it seems that if there is a reform that will be passed, it will be a scaled down version of what we've seen previously. So, they might end up being able to push back some of those reforms, but we'll just have to see.
Has the idea of a go-it-alone health plan for the Postal Service, has that died?
Never say never, Mike.
Right.
But at the same time, it's one of those proposals that members of Congress are really sort of reluctant to take up. And in some of the most recent proposals I've seen, it's disappeared entirely. And, you know, a lot of people debate what type of savings there are. The Postal Service says that they can negotiate better rates. But, you know, a lot of people say there's better efficiencies when you're with the larger system. So it's not a top tier. I wouldn't say it's a top tier issue nowadays. You know, what the Postal Service really wants is flexibility to reduce the workforce, the ability to end Saturday letter delivery, and the ability to sort of expand prices and products into markets that right now they really can't.
We've got about a minute to go. What's the situation, if any, on buyouts in the government?
Agencies are always looking at. I know in DOD there are more buyouts than in the civilian agencies because they are looking at a long term where they have to be smaller. So, you know, Air Force, Army, they're all looking at potential buyouts. In the civilian agencies, they're depending a lot more on attrition, but as the year goes on, if those numbers aren't met, we always do end up seeing more buyouts towards the end of the year if they occur at all. So that's really the picture right now.
Very good. Andy Medici, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for listening in, folks. Remember, these shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime, listen at home, and tell a friend. Thanks. We'll see you next week.
Always good to be here.
Here's Frank Konechny, Chief Technology Officer of the United States Air Force, on the Federal Executive Forum on Virtualization and Data Center Consolidation, sponsored by Dell Software.
If I put my application in a particular data center, I don't care where it is, I may have to have an SLA that says that automatically has to move to another data center if the data center goes down. And this has not been thought about before, because now if we put things in commercial that we don't trust, or we trust less, let's put it that way, we're going to have that issue.
To listen to the entire program made possible by the Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Dell Software Solutions for data center consolidation and virtualization help you transform your infrastructure and optimize application and service delivery. Manage physical, virtual, and cloud environments and a full range of endpoint systems. Monitor application performance. Perform zero-impact migrations. Do more with Dell Software, available through DLT Solutions. Learn more at dlt.com/dellsoftware. That's dlt.com/dellsoftware.
The Savvy Investor Radio Show is now on 1500 AM, Sunday mornings at 8.
Welcome to the Savvy Investor Radio. I am your host, Michael Connett. Savvy Investor Radio is by far the most complete and comprehensive financial planning program you can find on air, bar none. Each week we help listeners just like you create and grow wealth, protect and preserve it, and distribute it in the most tax-efficient manner while alive and after you pass. Truly the three pillars of our practice to help you grow, keep, and leave your wealth.
Listen Sunday mornings at 8 here on 1500 AM. And for more info, call Mike now at 866-597-1040.
Dr. Giannotto of the Giannotto Clinic is the expert that Washingtonians have come to rely on for age management and healthy living. And now you can listen to Dr. Giannotto on his weekly show, Wellness DC, Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. on 1500 AM. Join Dr. Giannotto as he takes your calls and shares cutting-edge strategies and techniques for a healthier lifestyle. Tune in Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. for Wellness DC with Dr. Giannotto on 1500 AM and streaming live on federalnewsradio.com.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.